The Breakfast Biographies are a series of feature interviews with intriguing Cape Breton characters we wanted to get to know better. Today, our guest is Gary Leach. Gary's a lecturer in political science at Cape Breton University. He's a writer and an investigative journalist. He's also had such a broad assortment of past jobs that his resume looks like somebody made it up. He's been a butcher, a cab driver, a U.S. Marine, a blackjack dealer, and he's had an ongoing passion for the people of Latin America for more than 30 years. Gary, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to see you.
Now, the one thing that's interesting about talking to you is that you can never have a boring conversation because of the sheer diversity of the spectrum of your experiences. And I was interested just in the range of jobs you've had. You have been a U.S. Marine.
Yep.
A Las Vegas blackjack dealer, a New York City cab driver, a punk rock musician, and a butcher in Detroit. Just to pick one at random, how'd you become a butcher in Detroit?
Well, it's actually after I got out of the Marines and I came home. My family was living in Detroit. We'd moved there from Manchester, England when I was 15. And I was actually looking to make some money. In the Marines, I'd been stationed in Panama, and that had introduced me to Latin America. And because that raised my curiosity about Latin America, so once I got out of the Marines, came back to Detroit, decided, okay, I got to find a way to make money. And I ended up applying for a job in a meat department, and they trained me to be a butcher. So basically, I went from being trained to kill humans to being trained to hack up animal carcasses.
And how did your family end up coming from Manchester, UK, to Detroit?
My dad worked for Massey Ferguson, the tractor manufacturer, for 28 years. He worked for them in Coventry. We moved from there to Manchester, and then they moved him to Detroit. And then after that, they moved him to Toronto in Canada. I didn't make that move with them, but so it was his job that brought us from industrial Manchester to industrial Detroit.
And how'd you end up being a Las Vegas blackjack dealer and roulette dealer?
Well, in the 90s, I decided, I was actually with my wife at that time, was traveling around the U.S. and Mexico on a motorbike we were, and camping, and did a six-week trip, left New York, sublet our apartment, and just took off to get away for a while. And she had her mother and sister lived in Las Vegas, so we stopped there, decided we needed to make some more money to move on. And then I found out how cheap university was there, and I wanted to start studying, go back to school and study more about Latin America, U.S. politics in Latin America. And we found out how inexpensive the university was there, so I decided to go back and finish university there and get my degree in political science with a focus on Latin America. And we didn't want to borrow money, take out student loans, because I knew I wouldn't make a lot of money in that field afterwards. So she worked full-time, and I worked 32 hours a week while I was in school. And the job I worked at was blackjack and roulette dealing in a casino, Golden Gate Casino on Fremont Street.
Well, what's the image that stands out to you from that period in your life and that job?
That Las Vegas is one unhealthy city. I mean, it has the highest rates of divorce, suicide, and homelessness in the United States, including family homelessness, child homelessness, because the gambling problems for people who live there, it's not so much a problem with the tourists that come in, but the people who live there, is just socially devastating. The social consequences of that culture is just brutal.
What was it that sparked your interest in Latin America?
The Marines. When I joined the Marines, and I don't know why I did that. That was an impulse. They sent me to Panama. I was deployed in Panama for 13 months. And that was my introduction to Latin America, that experience there. And once I got out of the Marines, I decided I wanted to go back and experience more of Latin America. And this was 1980 when I was there in the Marines. And ever since, I've been going back now for, 34 years.
And you still have a son in Panama?
A daughter.
A daughter.
I have a daughter and a granddaughter in Panama and another grandchild on the way.
Wow. And you still see them?
Yes, I go down there every year. Yeah, I was down there this past February. But I go down every year, and sometimes it's just me. Sometimes it's me, Terry, and our sons, Owen and Morgan. We all go down and hang out.
And that was from your time
as a Marine? That was from my time in the Marines in Panama, yeah.
So what was it about that place and that region, that place in the world that captivated you?
I think initially it was just, it was different, right? You know, I'd spent my whole life in Anglo cultures. You know, I'd grew up in England and then lived in the United States. And all of a sudden, at 19 years of age, I'm in Panama, this tropical, exotic, exciting country. And I just found it fascinating. I was just curious about the jungle, you know, the rainforest, the culture, the food, the music, the people. And it just captivated me. This was something, again, at that time, I was looking for adventure and different experiences. And this was radically different than anything I'd ever witnessed. And initially it was that. But then as time went on and I began to question more and more, why is there so much poverty and what's going on down here, and the U.S. role and perceptions of the United States by people down there, I started looking then at the connections between my life and my country, which was the United States at the time, and Latin America. And I started realizing that U.S. foreign policy has done a lot of harm down there. The role of multinational corporations down there has caused a lot of environmental destruction and created a lot of poverty. And a lot of our lifestyle here is basically supported by dependence on their natural resources, their cheap labor, and not just Latin America, but Asia and Africa. And I started making those connections, and that's what got me more politicized and eventually led me to decide I wanted to become an investigative journalist investigating this stuff.
Tell me about your experience in El Salvador.
Yeah, that was my first trip down after I got out of the Marines. And this was in late 1981, and that was the height of the civil wars in Central America, in El Salvador and Guatemala. And when I went to enter El Salvador from Honduras, I got detained at the border. They found a book of poetry by the punk rocker Patti Smith, and inside the cover was a black and white picture of her in a t-shirt holding a walkie-talkie. And the book was English, and they didn't read English, but they just assumed this was subversive literature. And they accused me of being a mercenary working with the Marxist guerrillas in El Salvador. And so they detained me, and I spent the next 8 days in a Salvadoran prison there in the custody of the Salvadoran army.
What kind of conditions?
They were pretty horrific. I mean, I was blindfolded. I had my thumbs tied together behind my back by shoelaces. I got beaten a couple times. The most brutal part was a Nicaraguan woman, middle-aged Nicaraguan woman who was arrested with me. The soldiers gang-raped her in the bathroom right next to our cell, and there's nothing I could do about it. I'm all tied up. And then I was moved to a cell by helicopter from there to the capital and put in a prison cell there where there's 11 of us in a cell that was basically 12 by 12 feet, just concrete floor, a toilet that didn't flush in the corner, and a brass pipe that ran up the wall with cold water for a shower. So, and the stench was foul. I mean, you got 11 men there in this 12 by 12 cell. And that was the last 4 days of my detention before the Red Cross discovered I was in there. And they notified the British consulate, who the next day got me out. So I wasn't a U.S. citizen at that time yet. I was still a British citizen.
And how old were you?
21.
Jeez. I guess you got your adventure.
Yeah, a little too much adventure there. But it, also, that was the start of my political awakening, right? Because the military was the U.S.-backed military that my tax dollars was funding that detained me. And the brutality I witnessed, again, not only the rape of this woman, but the beatings of others. And the final experience that convinced me, okay, this is what I want to focus on. I want to focus on investigative journalism, looking at the connections between our society here in North America and Latin America. The experience that finally made me make that decision was in the Amazon in Ecuador in 1989. I always wanted to go to the Amazon rainforest. So I went on the Napo River in Ecuador. I went down to a small town in the rainforest. And I was waiting for 3 days in this town for a supply boat to go downriver, and they kept telling me mañana. And finally, I said, okay, this is crazy. So I found an indigenous family that sold me a dugout canoe and a paddle for $15. And so I threw my backpack in there and got in my dugout canoe and just started paddling through the Amazon rainforest, as you do, you know.
You didn't know any better.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew nothing about canoes. I'd never been in a canoe in my life. And a few hours into it, all of a sudden, I'm on a bend of the river and it's fast flowing. And my instinct was, not knowing anything about canoes or kayaks, was when I saw a tree trunk sticking out of the water, was to try and paddle away, get away from this thing. Well, all I did was turn my canoe broadside, and the current carried me right into the tree trunk, and of course it capsized, and the canoe was gone. And I'm in this river holding onto this tree trunk with this waterlogged backpack, and I'm about 60 feet from the shore, this fast-flowing current, and up ahead is a whole mess of branches and trees and stuff floating on the surface. And I'm thinking, if I get taken to that, is the current going to take me underneath it? And, you know, I drown under there. And so I figure I'll hang out here, wait for a boat or signs of life. There's no signs of life anywhere. And so I'm sitting here, and the water is dark brown. I mean, you can't even see an inch below the surface. And I'm sitting there holding onto this tree trunk, my legs in the water, and I'm thinking, crocodiles, anacondas, piranha, electric eels, you know, it's like something's about to take a chunk out of my leg, right? And finally I decide I got to do something. So I said, I'm going to try and swim across the current to the shore. And I don't even make it 5 feet towards the shore before the current's hurtling me into this mass of branches and vegetation and stuff. But thankfully, obviously, it didn't drag me under and drown me. I managed to grab onto some of them and slowly work my way through that stuff to the shore and just walked along the river, continuing in the direction I'd been paddling, and eventually came to an indigenous dwelling. And of course, you got 6'1" gringo, soaking wet, with a soaking wet backpack, comes strolling into their yard of this indigenous family, you know. The kids recovered my canoe, and I stayed with them for 3 days. It was fascinating. They taught me all kinds of stuff about the rainforest. Their 8 and 12-year-old kids gave me canoe handling lessons. And when I left, I'm thinking, these people must be thinking, how on earth did the white man conquer the world? Because you know? To them, paddling a canoe is like one of the most basic things a human can do.
And now, at what point did you experience this cementing of...
Oh,
what
sorry,
you
I forgot
thought would
part.
Be your
yeah.
life's role.
The second indigenous community I stayed at, I walked into the village and it was abandoned. There's all these, you know, wooden houses on stilts with thatched roofs, and they're all abandoned. I'm walking through it and it's really eerie. And then I come across this little 5-year-old girl holding a little baby green parrot in her hand. And I asked, does anyone else live here? And her father came out of their house. I said, you know, can I sleep somewhere? Can I buy some food off you? And he said, yeah, take the next house. It's empty. There's a hammock in it. Sleep in it and I'll cook you some food. So I'm sitting there and they're feeding me some fish and some beans and some rice. And then he asked me, he says, would you like a Coca-Cola? And I'm like, Coca-Cola? I'm in the middle of the Amazon rainforest, right? There's no electricity, no running water, no roads, no anything. And I said, okay, yeah, I'll take a Coca-Cola. And the girl runs down and she opens this shed and it's stacked from floor to ceiling with crates of Coca-Cola. And so I asked the man, where on earth did all this come from? And the history of the village was that 16 years earlier, a U.S. oil company had arrived there, found oil. There's a lot of oil in this part of the Amazon in Ecuador. And told the indigenous people, you know what? We want to get oil here. You can work for us. You don't need to live the way you've been living. We'll bring in all the supplies you need on our boats, all the drinks, canned food, everything you need, clothing. And you work for us. And this is the way things will be from now on. And that's the way it was for 15 years. And the year before I arrived, the oil ran out and the company just left, right? This was devastating to this community. Number one, the oil company had polluted most of the streams, the river, the soil, the land, so they couldn't return to their traditional way of life. And a lot of them didn't want to after having all of these consumer goods shipped in, and especially the younger ones who'd grown up and spent most of their life under this so-called modern world, right? So most of the community had left. They'd abandoned the village and headed to the cities. And this was devastating. The arrival of the oil company devastated their culture, and then its departure devastated it again. And that experience gave me whole new insights into the role of multinational corporations in these regions, the impact on people, the cultures, and the environment. And this also happened 2 years after my father had had a major heart attack, and he went back to work a few months later and then was laid off. by Matthew Ferguson. He'd worked 28 and a half years, and he only got 50% of his pension because he didn't work the 30 years, and he became massively depressed. And so watching the way the company treated him, and then going to this indigenous village and seeing what these companies are doing to them, you know, all of this just finally, it's like, this is what I've got to focus on.
So you've been a New York cab driver, a punk rock musician, which we didn't even get into, a blackjack and roulette dealer in Las Vegas. You've been a U.S. Marine. You've been detained by the military in El Salvador during the Civil War. You've been traveled and seen desolation in the Amazon. You've been all over South and Central America. You've also, this is in a previous interview after your book Beyond Bogota, been detained by a rebel faction in Colombia in an isolated farmhouse. Do you ever wonder what it is about you that makes you do these things?
Yeah, and I still haven't figured it out yet. But my mother tells me that from a very young age, it was very difficult to rein me in. I had an adventurous spirit. She says they used to try and padlock the gate at the end of the garden. And at 3 and 4 years old, I would figure out how to get out. And so from a very young age, before I was even consciously thinking about any of this stuff, there was something in me that wanted to explore, push boundaries, seek adventure. And as I've gotten older, it's become more directed, you know. A lot of these things are all work-related to me. It's all about social justice, learning about the world, trying to figure out ways to make the world a better place and make myself a better person. And initially, it was just about adventures, exploring, and I wasn't always a leftist. In fact, I used to be quite an individualistic, conservative person in my 20s. It was these experiences in Latin America that shifted me.
And you live now, where do you live? You live in South Bar?
Yeah, South Bar.
Is that where you are? Yeah. South Bar with a partner, family, two young boys.
Yep, 8 and 5.
One of whom you're homeschooling, which I know you've said is one of the most significant and scariest adventures you've ever been on.
Yep, that's for sure.
How does the individualistic Marxist solitary wanderer adventurer adjust to have a life of domesticity and quiet Cape Breton?
It's actually been a very smooth transition. I mean, Terry and I lived in New York City in the middle of Brooklyn before we came to Cape Breton 10 years ago. So it was quite a shift. In fact, Cape Breton's the first time I've ever lived anywhere with less than 1 million people. But actually, I found it a very smooth transition. It was just the right time in my life. And then we started in our family here, having Owen and Morgan. 20 years ago, I would have struggled. You know, it would have been a real struggle to do it, but it was the right time for me. And I've loved my 10 years. I'm pretty much a homebody. I'm quite happy to just stay home, hang out with the kids. And even one of my favorite pastimes, if I get out of the house, is, you know, just to go sit at the bar, have a beer, and watch Manchester United play them. You know, a soccer game. I'm a big soccer fan.
Well, Gary, thanks for spending some yarns for us this morning. And here's to many more adventures, both on the domestic and international front.
Thanks for having me, and I'm sure there will be.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.